This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Edward Norton, wrote, directed, and stars in the film Motherless Brooklyn. He adapted it from a novel by Jonathan Lethem, but rewrote much of the story. Norton is known for his roles in films like American History X, Fight Club, The 25th Hour, Moonrise Kingdom, and Isle of Dogs. He's been nominated for 3 Oscars, including one for his performance in Birdman. Norton grew up in a diverse, planned community, Columbia, Maryland, which was designed by his grandfather, James Rouse, who was described in his New York Times obituary as a socially conscious, visionary developer who built new towns in the countryside, shopping malls in the suburbs, and festival marketplaces like Faneuil Hall in Boston. He used some of his profits to help generate housing for the poor. Rouse stands in contrast to the city planner and developer played by Alec Baldwin in Motherless Brooklyn. He's a corrupt power broker forcing working-class African Americans out of their neighborhoods to make way for new developments. Norton plays a private eye who stumbles on this corruption while investigating a murder. Norton's character is a loner who has Tourette's syndrome and is always explaining and apologizing for his tics, twitches, and verbal outbursts. In this scene, he's driving a young African-American woman, an activist, trying to prevent working-class black people from being forced out of their homes. The car radio is tuned to a jazz station, and he's trying to explain his tics and verbal outbursts like this one.
We bought Billy in the Metropolitan Opera House.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. It's kind of fun.
Yeah? Well, hang around a little while and see what you think.
F.
What is all that anyway?
I don't know. I never got a name for it. It's like a piece of my head broke off and got a life of its own and then just decided to keep joyriding me for kicks.
Kicks and ticks. Licks and ticks.
Sorry.
It's okay.
It's like living with an anarchist, you know, but the funny thing is it also has to have everything in its right place. Like things have to be ordered and lined up just right. Has to sound just right or else it really put me into knots until I fix it. Like I'm talking to you right now, right? But that part of my head, it's worrying. It's worrying that the bills in my wallet aren't lined up all in the right sequence and saying, stop talking to this girl and deal with this. It's not fair.
Hey, we all got our daily battles, right?
Yeah, fair enough.
Edward Norton, welcome to Fresh Air. Thanks for coming. I love the film.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
So you don't have Tourette's. You're not an orphan like the main character in Motherless Brooklyn is. But are there things you identified with about this character?
Sure. I mean, apart from an identification with compulsive tendencies and a tendency to have arguments with myself in my own brain, what makes any character great who has a heightened condition that's maybe more extreme than anything the rest of us live with is if we can still see ourselves in him. And I think Lionel's got paradoxes in him. He's got contradictions. He's really smart, but he trips himself up. He's pretty dysfunctional and chaotic too. He's tough. He's a Brooklyn street kid, but he's also really lonely and sad, you know? And I think whether or not you got Tourette's, you can relate to the feeling of being misunderstood or underappreciated. He's an underdog.
There's a part in the film where this character is having a conversation with a jazz trumpeter played by Michael K. Williams. And the character, Lionel, the detective, is trying to explain his like tics and obsessions and saying things that he doesn't mean to say and how his brain seems to have something wrong with it. And the trumpeter says, okay, you got a head that's always boiling over, turning things around, but that's music. It controls you. Some people call it a gift, but it's a brain affliction all the same. Did you write that?
Yeah.
And where does that come from? Do you feel that way about acting sometimes?
I do, yes. In a lot of ways, the trumpet player was me, in a sense that I've always felt, like when Lionel says to the trumpet player, yeah, but you know, at least you have a horn to push it out through and make it sound pretty. I'm just, you know, stuck twitching and shouting. I feel like acting gives me an outlet for a compulsion I have toward mimicry that I've always had as a kid, imitating people's voices, the sounds of their accents. It's a very reflexive thing for me. And I think acting also and writing, there's a lot of obsession with words in it, a lot of, I think, compulsive twisting around of words and language. That music that was playing in that scene you just played is from the great album Bird and Diz. And it's funny, like Bird and Diz is like, it's a jazz album that any movie actor can really relate to because they've got like four takes of Lester Leaps In and, you know, four takes of each of the tracks. In fact, this track called Bloomdito is the only one that there's a single take of it. They put multiple takes. And that's what film acting is. It's chasing a variation on a theme that lands right in your head. And I think I relate very much to that musical kind of impulse to keep twisting a phrase around until it hits some sort of state of zen in your head.
Mother's Brooklyn reminds me so much of Chinatown, but like the New York version. You know, Chinatown is set in L.A. in the 20s, 30s, 30s probably, right?
Yeah.
And what's really scarce in L.A. is water. So the mystery has a lot to do with water rights and corruption in water rights. And your movie, Motherless Brooklyn, is set in New York. And what's scarce in New York? Land rights. So this has to do with land rights and construction rights and redevelopment and somebody very corrupt behind a lot of it. And that corrupt person is named Moses Randolph, and they're clearly modeled on Robert Moses. And Robert Moses, you know, remade a lot of New York. He tore down a lot of buildings and buildings sometimes that he considered slums, and then built bridges and roads and theaters and beaches.
And the projects.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the housing projects, the federal, you know, which ironically in New York, many neighborhoods that were actually stable, working class minority neighborhoods were tagged slums so that federal money could be used to clear them and build things like the federal housing projects, which in fact became essentially the worst slums in New York.
Your grandfather, James Rouse, was a developer, and his emphasis was on building diverse communities for diverse economic and racial and ethnic groups to live in together. So did you see your grandfather as a kind of alternate version of Robert Moses?
Yeah, he certainly was. His values were almost polar opposite, diametrically opposed, however you want to put it, to Robert Moses. A lot of my grandfather's ethos and values come through the character that Willem Dafoe plays in the film. Willem Dafoe plays the brother of this sort of dark and powerful developer, city planner. And some of my grandfather's ideas about cities and the need to think of them in human terms and to think of the impact on people, not some abstract vision of progress or the future or infrastructure, but the idea of cities as a place that helped people become the best version of themselves. He had a very humanitarian, some would have said almost utopian kind of ideal that drove him. But he was also extremely effective. He was very prescient in terms of predicting what was going to lead to the decay of cities in the 60s and 70s. And he was a real visionary in terms of thinking about the ways that urban centers could be revitalized instead of being abandoned. And he was a big believer in community and culture and revitalization as opposed to the wrecking ball.
Among the things he did was develop malls and marketplaces in cities, including Faneuil Hall in Boston, Harbor Place in Baltimore, and in Philadelphia, the Gallery, which was considered, I think, either the first or one of the first urban malls.
In Philadelphia, actually, his nephew, my uncle, Willard Rouse, did a lot
right.
of the Philadelphia development.
That's
yeah.
right. That's right.
That was
that's
not
right.
that wasn't actually my grandfather, but the ones you're talking about, Baltimore's Inner Harbor and the Faneuil Hall, the marketplace in Boston, those were good examples of places that in cities that had been written off. Actually, the Baltimore Inner Harbor was literally a dump. It was a trash dump, and he saw opportunity in parts of city centers that had really been essentially relegated to being pockets of true decay. People told him he was crazy. You can't make a vital marketplace out of these parts of the city. And he proved people wrong over and over again and kind of brought life back into he was really one of the people who kind of shaped the modern urban renewal ideas that we've seen take place in a lot of places, where you've seen revitalization through creative reuse of sort of decrepit former industrial parts of cities. Even in New York, I worked on the High Line project. I was an early board member of this project where we turned an abandoned elevated rail track that was slated to be torn down into a park. And it was very much in the spirit of the things my grandfather loved, envisioning something as a place for people as opposed to simply like an old piece of infrastructure that needed to be torn down, which would have cost hundreds of millions of dollars and gotten the city nothing. And instead, we reimagined something and it became not just a gem in the city, but actually a big part of the economic revitalization of the whole industrial West Side.
I haven't been to that yet, but I've heard great things about it. What was your role in developing it?
I lived in the neighborhood, and I used to climb up on it and walk along this kind of wild stretch of tree-filled train tracks, and I was amazed by it. And then when I saw that these two guys, Joshua David and Robert Hammond, had launched this little community group initially just to fight against tearing it down, there wasn't a vision of a park originally. I joined forces with them. I became an early fundraiser and board member and advocate of that project from the early days of it. And those guys became some of the most noted civic heroes of my generation in New York. They won the Jane Jacobs Prize and really showed what people can do when they stand up and defend their city. There's a lot of that in Motherless Brooklyn, too. There's a scene where you actually go into the old Penn Station. Of course, that's like New York's great ghost. We lost Penn Station. We lost our great transcendent train station that you entered and exited the city from because of dark backroom deals. And people weren't aware of what was going on. And when it was gone, suddenly everybody was saying, how could that have happened? You know, how could we have lost our great rail station? Like, that's like Paris's Gare du Nord or Victoria Station. And now New York, you scuttle in underground like a rat. You don't have any, great transcendent experience of entering or exiting the city. And those kinds of wounds, those kinds of losses, I think are a lot about, Motherless Brooklyn's got a lot of that in it. I think it's like, what do we lose when people don't know what's going on in the shadows? You know, when we don't pay attention to the ways that powerful people are, rewriting the rules.
You know, we've been talking about Robert Moses, the very powerful developer in New York who had been Parks Commissioner, among other powerful jobs that he held in New York. And we were also talking about your grandfather, James Rouse, who was a very idealistic developer. So the developer in your movie, whose name is Moses Randolph, is inspired by Robert Moses, and you cast Alec Baldwin to play him, which is interesting in so many ways. And one of the ways it's really interesting is that, like, Alec Baldwin on Saturday Night Live plays Donald Trump, who is or was, a developer and
a racist property developer who's ruining the world.
Well, your words.
Yeah, but the thing is, here's the thing. I was finished writing this script by 2012. In 2012, our insane clown president was a game show host, and it was certainly not aimed at him. It was much more, to me, a kind of a distillation of the people that I think are the most dangerous and that I think, in a lot of ways, noir as a film tradition tends to look at, which is, who are the people in the shadows? Where is the power that's dangerous to us that we can't see?
Well, let's hear a scene with you and Alec Baldwin from Motherless Brooklyn. And you've been posing as a reporter trying to dig up information about the murder of your friend and mentor, who was the head of the detective agency where you worked until he was murdered. And you've managed to connect the murder to this corruption in this redevelopment scheme in New York that seems to be masterminded by Alec Baldwin's character. So you're talking to him knowing that he's a ruthless power broker with plans to tear down a lot of neighborhoods to create his vision in their place.
Is he above the law? Is that it?
No. I'm just ahead of it.
What's the difference?
Well, the law's a rule book we make for the times we find ourselves in. You rebuild the city, in my experience, the law will follow you and adapt to what you do.
Yeah, a lot of people like the city the way it is. Who are you rebuilding it for?
The people to come. 50, 100 years from now, what will matter of what we've done now? What will help people to make science fiction real? The laws of today were roads and bridges and tunnels for commerce to move swiftly over. Beaches and parks to let people escape the rat race and inspire the mind. Palaces of culture where hellish slums used to be.
It all sounds pretty grand, I guess. Unless you happen to be one of the people whose house is in the way right now.
Okay, it's a scene from Motherless Brooklyn with Alec Baldwin and my guest, Edward Norton. So when you cast Alec Baldwin to play the Robert Moses-like character, was Baldwin already portraying Trump on SNL?
Yes, he was already. He had been doing that.
And did that figure into casting him at all?
No. Really, in a way, the opposite. He and I both were like, do you think it matters that there's a couple little signposts on this? And it didn't to me, because there's just not that many actors like Alec who have the heft and that old world New York political boss like characteristic, you know? And he's so great with language. I cast Alec Baldwin because when I imagined that big final dark soliloquy in the pool at the end of the movie, I really couldn't think of very many people who I thought would do it better than him. I could hear him saying those things in my head.
Were you thinking of Glengarry Glen Ross also?
Of course, you know, coffee is for closers only. The yes. fact that I can sit here and say it, you know, the fact that you can remember a scene like that is a testament to something about the power of that actor's ability to deliver that kind of a line.
So you're a father now. You have a son who's about four?
He's six, actually.
Oh, okay. Did being a father affect your approach to work, the kind of movies you wanted to make, or how much work you wanted to take on?
Yes, definitely. I think I probably, for instance, would have gotten around to making this film, Motherless Brooklyn, sooner, possibly, than I did. I had it ready and I was ready to make it. But, you know, that when kids come into your life, like, you got to make a lot of room and space for that. The idea of like missing out on magical phases of early life and stuff like that, it's just to me, like, there's no movie that's worth that at all. And so the times that I've delayed on doing work or, just sort of like hit pause for family, it's not even... It's never really been a major debate for me. It's always a very easy decision. But the good news was, by the time I did this, you know, we were in good footing. I got to make the movie at home, which is a big deal, you know, like
in New York.
So
not
yeah,
in your
some
home.
People some,
in your house.
Yeah, no, but literally at home. Some people their dream project, it might take them to, you know, Romania and Egypt for Tunisia to shoot their film, you know, and I was working at times literally two blocks from home. Alec lives across the street from me. Willem Dafoe lives about four blocks down the other way. Most of the actors are old friends of mine.
Wow, that's a really neighborhood film.
Yeah, we shot all over in New York. But the pleasure of working at home and having family nearby, being able to be at home on the weekends, it was great. So I think that acting in films is a big commitment, and I take it seriously, so I dive into it. But directing is another level of commitment entirely, and I do understand why in some ways people that I really respect need time in between directing films.
So how many years did you work on Motherless Brooklyn?
Motherless Brooklyn I have worked on actively for I'd say about 15 years.
That's a really long time. Is it frustrating to know that you can work on a movie for 15 years and it can play in theaters for a few weeks and then be gone?
look, the gestation, it's not like I was sitting in my room trying to get it made for 15 years, not doing anything else. I made
I
made 20 films in that time. And I got nominated a couple times. I made some pretty good films. You know what I mean?
Like, yes, I know what you mean.
And I built some companies and sold them, had some kids. Like it's, I've been on the busier side of life. So the fact that underneath it, something was gestating, and it was a thing that needed gestation and needed sort of like the equivalent of slow cooking, you know, that's not pain. That's just a creative process. You know what I mean? This project needed that. And then eventually, because I'm persistent, I got it done. There was great victory in getting this movie done. It's very hard to get these kinds of films made at all these days. And unlike, you know, I mean, The Irishman cost $200 million and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood cost almost $100 million. I made this movie for like $26 million. So the pressures on it are very different. And we did it in 46 days. So I was very conscientious about trying to minimize the pressures of releasing the movie in the theatrical context by doing it in a very reasonable way.
Well, Edward Norton, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure, yeah.
Edward Norton wrote, directed, and stars in the film Motherless Brooklyn, which is based on a novel by Jonathan Lethem. Our book critic, Maureen Carrigan, has put together her list of the best books of the year, and it's a mix of books by authors old and new. Here's her top 10.
There's a lot to talk about, so let's just get into it. Here are my top 10 books of 2019. The Nickel Boys is yet another extraordinary novel by Colson Whitehead. Like The Underground Railroad, which just came out in 2016, The Nickel Boys is rooted in history and American mythology, yet it's painfully topical in its vision of justice and mercy erratically denied. In the early 1960s, an African-American teenager named Elwood Curtis finds himself wrongfully convicted of a crime and sent to a brutal reform school called the Nickel Academy. Whitehead's novel is short and intense, its chapters as compact as the isolation cells the Nickel Boys are thrown into and sometimes never leave. Susan Choi's Trust Exercise is a deliciously sharp and self-aware novel set in the 1980s in a performing arts high school. Two first-year students, David and Sarah, fall in love within the hermetically sealed world of the school, and Choi somehow makes out of that teenaged affair a wily meditation on memory and art. Choi tells us that the theater students live by the adage, acting is fidelity to authentic emotion under imagined circumstances. That's also not a bad description of how this novel, or any powerful novel, works. Any year in which a new novel by Ann Patchett comes out is a standout year in my book. The Dutch House is a subtle, devastating novel about a brother and sister who stand by each other through the loss of their parents, the home they grew up in, and the bedrock certainties about their shared childhood. I'm not exaggerating when I say that I've reread the ending of this novel at least 5 times, trying to unpack its sad magic. Out of all the novels that came out in 2019, Lost and Wanted by Nell Freudenberger is the one that I found myself buying over and over again to give to friends. Its main character, Helen Clapp, is a professor of physics at MIT. And when the story opens, her cell phone rings and an old friend's name comes up on caller ID. The problem is that friend has just died. From that classic creeper premise, Freudenberger crafts a deeply engaging novel about friendship, midlife puzzlement, and the mysteries of the universe. Like Freudenberger, Karen Russell always has her eye on the big picture. Orange World is Russell's latest short story collection, and it contains a masterpiece. That story, set in the Great Depression, is called The Prospectors. In 33 incandescent pages, Russell gives us the grit, desperation, and hollow dreams of deliverance that characterized that era. The other seven stories in this collection aren't so bad either. Poet Ocean Vuong emigrated to this country from Vietnam when he was 2, and his autobiographical novel called On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous explores the vexed situation of a child who surpasses his immigrant parents. Vuong's novel is structured in the form of a letter written by a son to his illiterate mother. "Dear Ma," the novel begins, "I am writing to reach you, even if each word I put down is one word further from where you are." In that single line, Vuong has captured the unintended rift that education can cause within a working-class immigrant family. On to nonfiction. Say Nothing by Patrick Radden Keefe is a panoramic investigation into the disappearance of a young widowed mother of 10 in Belfast, Northern Ireland in 1972, the era of the Troubles. Say Nothing belongs as much to the genre of narrative history as it does true crime. However you want to characterize it, it's a stunning book. The Yellow House by Sarah M. Broom is a sweeping, multi-generational memoir, focusing on her family's house in New Orleans, which was blown off its foundations when Hurricane Katrina hit. Broom pieces together a larger narrative about race, class, and the long-term toxic consequences of shame. 2019 was a very good year for essay collections, but of all the ones I've read, Emily Bernard's Black is the Body stays with me the most. Bernard writes with depth, poetic intensity, and humor about growing up Black in the South and living and teaching in the snow globe state of Vermont. Bernard's personal essays on race never hew to the safe or expected paths. And last, but certainly not least, in How We Fight for Our Lives, Saeed Jones writes about growing up Black, gay, and isolated in Texas. Jones's voice and sensibility are so distinct, he turns the traditional coming-of-age memoir inside out and upside down. Along with Sarah Broom and Ocean Vuong, Saeed Jones is one of the 3 debut prose writers on my top 10 list, which is a hopeful thing to take notice of, I think, as we move into the next decade.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can find her top 10 list on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you'll also find a link to NPR's Book Concierge, which includes hundreds of 2019 titles recommended by NPR staff and critics. Our next guest, David Harbour, stars in the popular Netflix series Stranger Things. And if you don't watch that, perhaps you recognize him from having hosted Saturday Night Live this season on an episode that was rebroadcast last month. On Stranger Things, Harbour plays the police chief in the fictional town of Hawkins, Indiana, in the 1980s, when the disappearance of a 12-year-old boy leads to the discovery of a secret government agency that kidnaps children with psychokinetic powers. Their experiments have accidentally opened a portal to an alternate dimension filled with monsters that start attacking the town. A few years earlier, Harbour's character, Jim Hopper, lost his daughter to cancer, which tore apart his marriage. When Stranger Things begins, he's suffering from depression and self-medicating himself with pills and alcohol. But as he's drawn into the supernatural events surrounding Hawkins, he's able to draw himself up and become a hero, albeit a flawed one, as he bands together with a group of adolescents to fight the monsters. He even adopts a girl who's escaped from the secret government agency. She goes by the name Eleven and is played by Millie Bobby Brown. David Harbour spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. They started with a clip from season 3 of Stranger Things. Jim Hopper's adopted daughter now has a boyfriend. The couple spends a lot of time in her bedroom making out, and it's driving Hopper crazy. So he seeks advice from Joyce, the mother of one of the band of kids, who he also has feelings for. Joyce is played by Winona Ryder.
And then Elle, she just slams the door right in my face.
Uh-huh.
You know, it is that smug son of a bitch, Mike. He's corrupting her, I'm telling you. And I'm just gonna lose it. I mean, I'm gonna lose it, Joyce.
Just take it down, Hopper.
I need for them to break up.
That is not your decision.
They're spending entirely too much time together. You agree with me about that, right?
Well, I mean, they're just kissing, right?
Yeah, but it is constant. It is constant, okay? That is not normal. That is not healthy.
You can't just force them apart. I mean, they're not little kids anymore, Hop. They're teenagers. If you order them around like a cop, then they're gonna rebel. It's just what they do.
Well, so what? I'm just supposed to let them do whatever they want?
No, I didn't say that. I think you should talk to them.
No, no, because talking doesn't work.
Not yelling, not ordering. Talk to them. You know, like a heart-to-heart.
A heart-to-heart? What is that?
You sit them down and you talk to them like you're their friend. I find if you talk to them like you're on their level, then they really start to listen. And then, you know, you could start to create some boundaries.
Boundaries?
Yeah, but, Hawk, it's really important that no matter how they respond, you stay calm. You cannot lose your temper.
Maybe you could do it for me?
That's a scene from Stranger Things, Season 3, between Winona Ryder and our guest David Harbour. David Harbour, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
So your character, Jim Hopper, what's his arc in the third season? It seems like he's frustrated a lot. He's frustrated that his adopted daughter and her boyfriend don't respect him. He's also frustrated romantically. I think he has feelings for Winona Ryder. How did you decide to play him this last season?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you know, he's gone through a lot of stuff over the years. It's been 2 years, and, you know, in the first year, he was sort of struggling with, you know, sort of coming alive again after the death of his daughter and fighting this monster. And then in season two, he struggles further with opening up, and again he fights a huge interdimensional monster, and this season his greatest challenge arises, which is his daughter starts kissing boys in the other room next to him. And I think that, like, he's crazier than ever this season, and I think that's the fun kind of paradox of the show, is that, or even the character, is just a guy like Hopper who is very capable in certain ways. Like, he's a very capable detective. He's a very capable, you know, in season two, he's building tripwires outside his house. I mean, he's a very capable man in certain ways. And then when it comes to relationships, he's sort of incapable. And certainly in terms of raising a teenage daughter, he's just completely incapable.
He's not prepared for that at all.
Right. And so it sort of thrusts him into the arms of Joyce, in a sense. I mean, she's a single mother who's done very well by it. And I think that the initial, there is attraction and sort of longing underneath there. But the big impulse this season is that he needs some help for, you know, being a single parent. I think he has no idea. And I think that's really what binds them now.
Well, let's hear a great scene with one of your two main female co-stars in Stranger Things. We heard a scene with Winona Ryder. Let's hear one with Millie Bobby Brown. Just for people who haven't watched the show, I guess there's some people out there. She plays Eleven, who's a young girl who was stolen at birth from the secretive government agency, who's been doing experiments trying to weaponize, like, her. She has supernatural abilities. And so she's not really socialized because she was, like, kept in isolation. And by season two, your character has actually adopted her. And I wanted to play a scene from that season. I'm not going to get too much into the plot, but Eleven had run away to try to find her birth mother. And she's come back, and she's actually, she looks a little different. She looks a little more rock and roll. So let's you guys are sitting in your car together talking before, like, a big, big action scene.
I shouldn't have left.
No, it's not a new kid. I should have been there. I should never have lied to you about your mom. or about when you could leave. A lot of things I shouldn't have done. Sometimes I feel like I'm... like I'm just some kind of black hole or something.
Black hole?
Yeah, it's a... you know, it's this thing in outer space. It's like... it sucks everything towards it and destroys it. Sarah had a picture book about outer space. She loved it.
Who's Sarah?
Sarah? Sarah's my girl. She's my little girl.
Where is she?
Well, that's kind of the thing, kid. She left us.
Gone.
Yeah. The black hole. It got her. And somehow, I've just been scared, you know? I've just been scared that it would take you too. I think that's why I get so mad. I'm so sorry for everything. I could be so... so...
stupid.
Yeah. Stupid. Just really stupid.
I've been stupid too.
I guess we broke our rule. I don't hate it, by the way, this whole look. It's kind of cool.
Bitch him.
Okay, sure. Bitch him.
That's a really great scene. I mean, you hear you trying to connect, trying to explain these really complicated things, trying to just, I don't know, just get to regrets you have. I mean, it's just really wonderful. I mean, did you guys practice that scene a lot before doing it?
Not really. I mean, one of the great things about that whole season was just that Millie and I, at that point, that comes in episode 9, I think. And so we had been working together for months and months, and we had just sort of developed this relationship, both on and off screen, that was very, you know, father-daughter and mm-hmm. complex in a certain way. And so I remember when we got to it, I don't think we rehearsed it at all. Like, I think I said to the Duffers, you know, that I always like shooting Millie early because she's so strong when she's just like letting it happen and, you know, when it's new for her. And so I don't think we even read it through. I think we just turned the cameras on and we just did it. There's something very unspoken between the two of us that really got developed during that season and continues to this day. I don't have kids, but I mm-hmm. feel very strongly protective of her. Mm-hmm. And so those scenes are very easy to play in a certain way.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Like, how do you navigate your relationship with these younger actors? Because I'm sure it's sometimes you do feel parental towards them. I mean, you're acting as a parent towards one of them. I bet at times they come to you casting you in a parental role off set, but of course you're not their parent.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has all the complexity that you could imagine. I mean, there are these wonderful parental things that you feel and that open you up. And there are scenes, you know, where you'll do a good scene and they'll come over and hug you afterwards. And that's not happening with other actors that I work with, you know. But then there also is all the annoyance of being a parent, too. Like, I felt like they throw tantrums or they make, you know, fart jokes all the time. You know, and then the other thing is that they're all going through puberty now. They're like 15. And right. So they want to talk about things that it's not appropriate for me to talk to them about. Right. And they'll come up and ask things. And I'll be like, I need to go get a cup of coffee. And you guys could discuss that among yeah. yourselves. But that is not my job.
I'm going to exit here. Yeah.
I have no good authority. Well, maybe I do not want to talk to you about this.
It's also interesting because, you know, you're really gaining a lot of celebrity from the show the same time they are. But, you know, you're in your 40s and they're teenagers. But what's like sharing that experience with them?
I mean, I worry for them, and probably unnecessarily, because I'm viewing it through my own lens. Mm-hmm. And my particular lens has been that fame is a very tricky thing. And I've always felt that I was very grateful for the mistakes that I was able to make in my teens, 20s, even 30s, like big grand mistakes, because they were not seen by a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it allowed me a certain creative freedom where I could really find my own voice before that voice got adulation. And the problem with a 12-year-old is when you tell a 12-year-old that they're a genius, I think there's got to be some protection over what they've been doing. And I don't want a 12-year-old to be the same person as a 25-year-old or a 30-year-old. So right. I think there's a danger in giving too much adulation to someone so young. I think we should, I mean, my view, I would love it if everybody was just really excited about the work they did, but just remained completely quiet and didn't tell them. And then we could, you know, and then they could develop and grow as artists and become, because I want these kids to become the next Meryl Streeps or Daniel Day-Lewis's or whatever of our industry. I want them to be the leaders creatively. And I worry about them being stilted because of so much adulation.
You've been candid about being diagnosed with bipolar disorder and actually being institutionalized, I think, in your mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
Before you were diagnosed and started getting treatment, do you think that having bipolar disorder affected the way that you acted?
Oh, God, yeah. I think there's always been a link between creative people and what society defines as mental illness. I think that, you know, for me personally, one of the things that I've felt my life has been that I've been somewhat of an outcast, or I've been sort of too sensitive for a lot of people. I've been too much in a certain way. And so mm-hmm. acting allowed me to channel all of this neurosis, this sensitivity into a character. And I think in a certain way, I mean, one of the, if you could, I sort of like to be very diverse in my characters, but if you mm-hmm. could call me a certain brand, I guess it would be sort of a heroic outcast in a sense, mm-hmm. because I am a big guy and I know how to fight. Mm-hmm. But at my essence, I have a lot of empathy for those people who are lost and who feel like they don't really know what's going on, because I myself have been there.
You started getting treatment and have said that you got medication. Were you worried at all that like taking medication would like dampen your ability to act?
I'm still worried about it.
You are?
Yeah. I mean, I do. I continue to take medication for this. I have found, though, the thing that has benefited my stability in this by far has been psychoanalysis and the validation of my narrative by the culture to a certain degree. Fame has also helped my problems. And so medication does have a place in this. I think for acute cases, it can be very helpful. But I think if you don't go into the trauma, as I didn't for years, I use medication, but I would descend again and again, and I would continue to have problems. I've been in psychoanalysis for 4 years, and I've been very stable for 4 years. Hmm. And that's a direct correlation, whereas I've taken medication for, 18 years, and I have not been very stable under simple medication. And so, although medication has helped in certain ways.
Did you start talking about this stuff publicly after Stranger Things?
I did, yeah.
And did you feel like you were doing a public service in some ways, sort of showing that here you are an actor who has been able to be successful and you've had to deal with these issues? And
I mean, I've always wanted, you know, I've always wanted to do it in a very dramatic way too. Like I had a whole speech prepared for an award I was, you know, and I didn't win, and so that ruined it. But it was
you didn't
I
stand was, up and say, "Wait, I have something to say."
Exactly. I was so excited, and then you know, because I do feel like I want kid. If you're a kid and you like, you know, live in Oklahoma and you're 10 years old and you just got diagnosed with OCD or ADHD or, you know, bipolar, I want you to know that you can be a powerful, strong, successful, even strong cultural voice in this world with this, you know, label attached to you. It doesn't define you, and it's certainly not a death sentence. If anything, like the neuroatypicality, I think propels you to being a greater free thinker and more equipped for creativity in certain ways. And I would encourage all those people to not feel outcasted and to act out in bad in ways that can be gnarly, but to actually embrace like their artistic sides and to realize that their outcastness and their differentness is also linked to their specialness. They are intertwined in a beautiful way.
David Harbour, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, man. It was my pleasure.
David Harbour stars in the Netflix series Stranger Things. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.